Issues, Etc. is listener-supported. That means we rely on you for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. Please consider making a tax-deductible gift to Issues, Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org, or by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for your support.
I will not seek re-election as governor. I've never believed that I nor anyone else needs a title to do this, to make a difference, to help people. I'm determined to take the right path for Alaska, even though it is unconventional and it's not so comfortable. With this announcement, I've determined it's best to transfer the authority of governor to Lieutenant Governor Parnell.
Well, that's Sarah Palin from Friday's surprise announcement, right before the holiday weekend, and everyone's wondering, why did she choose that time? What has she really decided to do? And she's not saying much, except that as the 26th, the reins of government in Alaska get handed over to her lieutenant governor. And what happens to Sarah Palin after that? I mean, one moment she is on the ticket for the GOP ticket for the presidency, the vice presidency, and then she's back in Alaska. And then with very little of her term served, she's decided to leave the governor's mansion. It's hard to figure out. Maybe we'll find out. I want to know, is this political suicide? I was just coming in this morning. I heard someone who I very knowledgeable in politics on the radio say political suicide. It's over for her. It's a bad move, whatever she's decided to do. Mark Hemingway joins us to talk about Governor Sarah Palin's political future. I want to hear from you as well. 1-877-623-6943-877-623-MYIE, or talkback at issuesetc.org, talkback at issuesetc.org. Mark Hemingway is a regular guest and staff writer for National Review Online. He joins us live from Washington. Mark, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Do you think this is political suicide for Governor Palin?
Well, I think it's political suicide if you're talking about a presidential run in 2012, but beyond that, I mean, I wouldn't really feel comfortable, you know, judging anything, you know, that judging this to be anything that dramatic. You know, Palin is young. I mean, you know, 2016, 2020, you know, I mean, elections in those years, are, whether it be for senator or president or whatever, are a long way off. And, you know, she's young enough that these are things that she's probably thinking about.
Mark, you said this would be political suicide if she's thinking about 2012. Why is that? Do the calculus for me.
Well, you know, Sarah Palin wasn't a terribly experienced governor, you know, as it was. I mean, you know, she did not have a lot of political experience under her belt when she was selected, you know, to be John McCain's running mate. So, I mean, the idea was that, you know, certainly by 2012, you know, she could at least get one term as governor under her belt and have one term as governor under her belt and, you know, and more experience beyond that, maybe. So, you know, but if she steps down from, you know, holding political office, I mean, what record is she going to run on? Having spent, you know, 2 months as part of a presidential campaign and, you know, spent a few years as governor, that's an awfully slight resume for someone who wants to run for president or, you know, or, so I think, you know, that in that sense, it'd be political suicide for 2012. Now, if you're looking at maybe running for senator in Alaska or something down the road, then, you know, who knows?
Okay, then let's talk about why the reaction to it. Is all of it just kind of the fact that the GOP is a little rudderless and definitely leaderless at this point?
That is a lot to do with it, and certainly coming on the heels of the Sanford scandal and some other things. I mean, there's just a lot of people, you know, that want, you know, to want this to feed into the storyline that the GOP is imploding. And well, that's true to a certain extent. And there's definitely, you know, I think it's pretty fair to say that the GOP is rudderless. I think it's far too early to read too much into what's going on here in terms of what this means for Sarah Palin and what she's doing here. And, you know, what this means for the national GOP. I mean, the idea that Sarah Palin was going to be the savior of the GOP was a highly dubious proposition at best, as popular as she was, as popular as she is. So, you know, again, I mean, I understand that this is a big thing and why, and I understand that people are talking about it, but, you know, I think that people should, you know, probably the best thing to do here would be to calm down a bit and survey the landscape and, you know, wait a while and figure out what her plans are before you even start pronouncing judgments about what this means for the future of the Republican Party and what this means for Sarah Palin personally.
Did the announcement surprise you, Mark?
Oh, I think it surprised everyone. I mean, I still honestly, as an observer of what's going on and, someone who's followed this closely, have no idea what prompted it. You can take a guess at some things. Certainly the attention directed at her family was, certainly unwelcome, I'm sure, as far as she was concerned. And a lot of it was just, completely beyond the pale and awful. And I think that there would be a natural, temptation as a mother to step down and to try and circle the wagons a little bit and get control of your public image a little bit, such that the rest of your family doesn't have to suffer. And I certainly think that the ethics charges that people were bringing that were very frivolous from what I can tell. We're draining on her financially and some other things. At the end, in an ideal circumstance, being governor of Alaska should kind of be a, 3 hours on Tuesday kind of job. People and the fact that she got elevated to doing this on a national stage, certainly made a lot of aspects of the job, I'm sure, untenable and very, very unpleasant.
How would you characterize the reaction of party leaders to this announcement?
Well, that's a good question. I think it's a combination of befuddlement and relief, in the sense that Sarah Palin was, as much as she is a dynamic personality, a wonderful fundraiser, and I'm sure the Republican Party wants to be able to wants to be able to utilize that aspect of her as much as possible. She's so polarizing and such a lightning rod in so many ways that the idea, at least for the foreseeable future, she's not, going to be necessarily looking to, or if she is, it's going to be hard for her to elbow her way into being, the top voice in the party. It was probably something of a relief, I imagine.
What is it about her that, or her views, that the GOP leaders consider so polarizing?
It has nothing to do about her views. I think that her views are perfectly fine. Her views are, she's a fairly libertarian, a governor, with some, a strong belief in her state. And, she's mostly, libertarian on an economic level, but, she does believe in some, certain conservative social values that put her pretty firmly in the mainstream of the Republican Party. The issue is more just how polarizing she's been, in the sense that her opponents, and I say opponents loosely, and by opponents I mean most of the media establishment, have gone out of their way to demonize her in a way that I think is it's unbelievable. I have no real I'm not invested one way or the other in seeing Sarah Palin run, become president one day or anything like that. I think she's got a lot to prove, but I'm absolutely flabbergasted at the effort that's been expended to try and basically destroy her and her political career and go after her family and things like that. I mean, it's absolutely mind blowing. I mean, you have, Andrew Sullivan, who is a writer for The Atlantic, one of the most respected intellectual magazines in the country. The president quotes him in his press conferences, and he's been engaged in a positively deranged quest to prove that Sarah Palin is not the mother of her daughter, mother of her son, Trigg Palin, and has been covering up for her daughter, who actually gave birth to him, for, ever since he was announced back in September. I mean, this continues this day. I mean, it's absolutely insane. And if you ask, people that hate Palin, why do they hate Palin? I mean, they'll tell you all kinds of stories. They'll tell you that they hate Sarah Palin because she doesn't believe in evolution, thinks dinosaurs walked the earth 4,000 years ago. They will tell you that she made women pay for her own rape kits. They will tell you that she banned books from the Wasilla Library. They will tell you that, she doesn't believe in sex education or contraceptives. And like every single one of those stories is demonstrably not true. And yet these things get, bandied about, to this day. I think it's just an issue of, there's certain contradictions there, as far as being a staunch Republican and also at the same time being, a progressive in the original sense of that word, feminist, that really just, it's kind of a missile aimed at the heart of people on the left of this country. They just cannot believe that someone with those contradictions could be so successful, and they think that it's a horrible role model, and they recognize it as a threat to the worldview that they would like to see. So, I'm that there's, it's very difficult to say what exactly it is, but there's something about her that really just divides people.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Mark Hemingway, staff writer for National Review Online, live from Washington, about Governor Sarah Palin's political future. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. live this Monday afternoon, the 6th of July.
Would you like to post your favorite Issues Etc. audio segments on your website or blog? Well, we've made it easy for you. Just go to the on-demand page of our website, issuesetc.org, click the embed green logo, and copy and paste the embed code on your website or blog. It's just like posting a YouTube video. Embed Issues Etc. audio on your website or blog today. We love our on-demand listeners. Old theology, new technology. Issuesetc.org.
Thanks for sending us your email. Having produced Issues Etc. for more than 15 years, I can tell you that we've never received email response like this. Unfortunately, we simply can't reply to all of your email. So here's a way that I can almost guarantee a response to your question or comment. Call the Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8384. It's available for your questions or comments 24/7, 618-223-8384.
No consultants necessary. You're listening to Issues Etc.
We at NewReformationPress.com are committed to providing a hand-picked selection of books and teaching materials that educate, inform, and entertain while relentlessly focusing on the gospel. Discover our growing library of resources by Dr. Rod Rosenblatt of the White Horse Inn radio program, including his powerful address, The Gospel for Those Broken by the Church, or Bible in an Hour by Pastor Wade Butler. And be sure not to miss our selection of t-shirts, gifts, and artwork. NewReformationPress.com. Finally, Reformation theology made accessible.
On behalf of the staff of Issues Etc., thanks to each and every one of the more than 7,600 who signed the online petition to bring back Issues Etc. Doris Spurn, J.J. Teske, John Butcher, Lauren Mine, James Mold, Hal Holler, Lisa Garr, Tricia Kletke, Philip Hodgson, and Earl Bengel. Thanks for your support.
Dear Mr. President, come take a walk with me.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Mark Hemingway is our guest on this Monday afternoon, July the 6th. I want to know what our listeners think about Governor Sarah Palin's announcement of her resignation coming later this month. Give us a call or email us, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MY-IE. Or talk back at issuesetc.org. Mark Hemingway is staff writer for National Review Online. He's joining us live from Washington, D.C. President Obama is in Russia. What is the goal of this meeting?
Tensions with Russia have been mounting for some years now. It's become fairly clear that Vladimir Putin wants to, you know, sort of centralize and hold on to power in that country. And the current administration, you know, is sort of the belief that the Bush administration's foreign policy, and this is a fair criticism in some respects, not so fair criticism in others, was far too unilateral. And so that they're trying to, you know, before we get, you know, tough with Russia over things like missile defense and oil pipelines and all these other key strategic things that we have to iron out with Russia, they want to, you know, establish some, diplomatic channels and make it clear to the current, you know, Russian administration that there's sort of a new sheriff in town and try and convince them that they are more open to working with the country than the previous administration had been. Of course, you know, whether or not a guy like Vladimir Putin, you know, is willing to engage in diplomacy, you know, rather than, you know, simply, you know, go about what he wants and what he thinks is best for Russia in a very single-minded way is a very good question. A lot remains to be seen there.
On the international front as well, do you agree with those who consider the Obama administration's reaction to North Korea's recent saber-rattling too timid?
Yeah, I mean, I stated on an instinctual level, I feel like it's been too timid. That said, you know, I'm actually sympathetic to the Obama administration in a lot of ways. I mean, you look at a lot of the foreign policy situations you are dealing with, you know, places like North Korea and Russia. There are really no good options in terms of what you can do. I mean, you know, North Koreans have been starving to death for, you know, decades under the, you know, harsh rule of that country, you know. So it's not like, you know, imposing, you know, tougher sanctions or anything is necessarily going to affect the will of the people in that country. I mean, they've been suffering for so long. I mean, they're not even going to notice. And, you know, certainly there are, you know, Russia has a stranglehold on certain strategic things in the region, you know, oil, gas, you know, nuclear, it's a nuclear power and all these other things. So there aren't necessarily a lot of good options. So I am sympathetic to this idea of going in and saying, okay, we're going to try and be nice here and try and do everything we can to convince you that we are willing to work with you. That said, you know, once that option is, you know, is rebuffed, I mean, where does that leave them? It doesn't leave them anywhere, frankly. So I wish them the best, but, you know, I'm not terribly hopeful that anything will come of their approach to North Korea and Russia. The one thing I would say is that the one area of foreign policy that just boggles my mind that they're handling the way they are is Honduras. I mean, what they're doing is absolutely mind-boggling. If you look at the situation on the ground there with the deposed leader, you know, they basically have an open and shut impeachment case against the leader. What happened when they, put him out of power was, you know, explicitly outlined in the Honduran Constitution. Seems to be a victory for the rule of law. His replacement in the country is a member of the same political party as the deposed President Zelaya. So, I mean, and the people of the Hondurans seem to support the actions of deposing the president by 70-80%. So why the president and the Organization of American States seems to want to weigh in on the side of the deposed president, who's just, you know, Hugo Chavez, you know, stooge, and, you know, clearly would probably act in not in the interest of the United States is beyond me.
Here at home, what's the current status of Sonia Sotomayor's nomination?
I don't know the exact status in terms of, you know, how things are proceeding through the Judiciary Committee and you know, what's going to happen there. I mean, my sense of it is that, you know, she's eventually going to be confirmed without too much of a fight for a variety of reasons. You know, there are certainly some troubling aspects about her and her past, but, you know, I don't think that she's in a position where she's not necessarily going to tip the court to the left, and the mechanics of the Supreme Court are actually very complicated. And I've heard some rumblings among Republicans that the appointment of Sotomayor might actually be a good thing for them, because you have Justice Anthony Kennedy who sort of sits in the middle on things. But, you know, if you got someone like Sonia Sotomayor in there, who there are whispers that she's kind of a bully on the bench, and she's, you know, can be quite obnoxious to deal with, that if she were to get in there and be, you know, sort of a fiery leftist, you know, and not exactly sensitive to the politics of the court, she'd probably push Kennedy to the right a lot, and that might very well end up being good for Republicans.
On national health care, I was talking to Congressman John Shimkus late last week, and he said, you know, they're kind of hunkering down. They expect that between now and the midterm elections, the leadership and the administration is going to get what they want on this. What do we think they want, and do you think it's actually doable between now and midterm elections? He said the sense was they have to get it done before the midterm elections because they may not be able to get it done after that.
I would agree with that assessment of the timeline from what I know. I mean, the big sticking point here in national health care is, of course, is to what extent it's going to have what's called a public option, which would be a publicly created insurance plan, you know, subsidized by taxpayers, that would compete against private insurance companies. Now, obviously, this is a huge sticking point for a variety of reasons. For one thing, it's not really fair to have a public insurance plan to compete against private, you know, healthcare health insurance companies. I mean, private health insurance companies have to turn a profit. If a public health insurance plan doesn't turn a profit, well, then it's just going to be subsidizing more tax funds. And so a lot of people think that this is a big stalking horse for single-payer sort of socialized medicine, you know, even insist that this is, you know, just, you know, utilizing market mechanisms. Looking at the mechanics of it, I just can't imagine it's not eventually a stalking horse for, you know, sort of a government single-payer, you know, healthcare vision down the road. Furthermore, there's all kinds of problems with it in the sense that, like, when they introduced Medicare in the early 60s, you know, the medical costs just exploded, and, you know, so a new, you know, full-blooded public option like this, then, you know, costs are going to explode again. Plus, it's, you know, there's all kinds of ripples it's going to have through the health industry. You know, are the doctors necessarily going to take, you know, the public insurance plan? Are they going to be required to? There's a lot of problems with it. Obviously, you know, Republicans, pro-business Republicans, and, Republicans who are, you know, ideologically concerned about the government meddling in the free market like this. I mean, the health industry represents about 17% of the economy, and, you know, this opens things up for, you know, tremendous amounts of corruption, could very well, be a big, you know, economic drag on the country. So there's a lot of Republicans and frankly a lot of conservative Democrats that are worried about this public option. So they are trying to figure out how to, like, but at the same time, the hardcore Democratic base is very committed to this public option. So they're trying to find a way to include a quote unquote public option here, in such a way that they can get the votes to pass this. Whether that means that it's, you know, becomes a sort of toothless symbolic public option, or whether or not, you know, they're able to, you know, claw their way through the House and Senate and get a robust public option is very much up in the air. But I would agree. Certainly, if they don't do it before the midterm elections, then I don't think it's going to happen. And for one thing, unless the economy, you know, dramatically improves, I can't imagine that the Democrats aren't going to lose some seats the way things have been going.
Mark Hemingway is a staff writer for National Review Online. We'll post a link to Mark's columns under the on-demand page of our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. Mark joined us live from Washington, D.C. Mark, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thanks for having me.
When we come back, Hour 2 of Issues, Etc. is straight ahead. Dr. Andrew Steinman is going to join us. We're going to be remembering, along with the church on this day, Old Testament saint and prophet. This is the big prophet. This is the big book. This is the one that, if you're familiar with any Old Testament prophet and prophecies, this would be it. Isaiah. We'll find out the big story on Isaiah when we come back from this break. And then Father Todd Wetzel and Father Philip Ashe will join us, both from Reform groups within the Episcopal Church USA. We will find out exactly what's going on later this week in Anaheim, California, when the Episcopal Church USA meets for its general convention. What are they going to be talking about? What things will they avoid talking about? Then Dr. Robert Gagnon will join us in the last part of that second hour. Federal hate crimes legislation. The Attorney General's trying to ease people's concerns, in particular, ease religious groups' concerns about federal hate crimes legislation. Does it have to do with speech, or does it only have to do with behavior? He's trying to say it's only a matter of behavior, it's not a matter of speech, but I don't know. It's hard to tell whether or not hate crimes legislation can be limited to behavior and not include public speech. Dr. Robert Gagnon of Pittsburgh Theological Seminary will join us to talk about federal hate crimes legislation a little later in Hour 2 of Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Stay tuned.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues, Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.